Are you ready to join us as we explore the cutting edge of leadership and innovation by equipping you with the most impactful insights as well as strategies to shape your leadership and legacy? Welcome to Legacy Leader Show. We're super thrilled here today to explore fascinating interaction of leadership, biotechnology, and healthcare with our guest, Rachel Geran. She is not only a trailblazer in AI-driven medical innovation, but she's also a dedicated leader in nonprofit sector with amazing background that I absolutely cannot wait for you to discover. Let's dive into it. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you, Isabella. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely honor and pleasure to have you as well. And for someone that is so obviously, not only capable to navigate current complexity, but someone to navigate some very delicate situations with your track record and everything you did thus far. I just want to say, guys, buckle up and enjoy the ride. So, Rachel, do you mind sharing a little bit about how did you even became such a obviously very visible, strong figure in United States Air Force? As well, got into military and get where you are here today.
Absolutely. So, first, even my humble roots come from my family, which is military. So, that was really my introduction and appreciation for the military. I went to the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. So, I actually graduated in 1995, quite a bit ago. But when I was there, I started out with pre-med. My idea was to get into potentially medicine. I had actually started with aerospace engineering. It was interesting. I was a little bored with it. So I moved over to the medical side, and then I started working with aerospace physiology was actually my focus. And when I got out of the when I graduated, I was in the biomedical science corps. So I was fortunate enough to be able to work in the Air Force in a field that I had actually studied for at the academy. Of course, a lot of people go they'll fly navigation, which wasn't quite where my passion was. So I was able to get into aerospace physiology, where working with humans and what happens when they go in space, into that environment. And I worked more with the actual chamber units. We also did overall wellness briefs, making sure that the human was the pilots, the navigators, all the supporting air crew were performing at their best in those environments. So we also did training on visual perceptions, all of the different things that can impact from a mental standpoint, as well as on the physical standpoint, in those situations. So our job was really to make sure that they were best prepared for those environments. And in there worked with all levels of ranks from airmen to generals, worked with special forces as well, with different things that we did there. And then when I transitioned out of the Air Force as a company grade officer, we're really sought after for leadership skills, because in the military, we have a lot of great opportunities when were coming up through the ranks to really be in leadership. And I should actually, right before I left, I was a section commander. So I worked with the group command level as well, where my responsibility was to make sure that rules and regulations were being followed. I even had some opportunity working with non-judicial punishment aspects and setting things up. So I also was able to learn a lot from that perspective, working with my first sergeant. And I would share in that role, I really learned a lot as well of the importance of the job that we do, but the balance of the personal side, because especially in the military, you're really 24/7 and there's a lot of intersection there. And I leaned a lot on my first shirt in the senior enlisted to learn a lot as well. Of course, that comes a bit from my roots. My father is retired Army, spent a couple tours in Vietnam, and was learned a lot from him just in general and how I was brought up. So when I got out of the Air Force and I was looking for opportunity, I was with my background in aerospace physiology, I was kind of put forward into medical sales, pharmaceutical sales, and that was an interesting position to be in. It's a completely different world, which would be a whole different episode if you're talking about medicine and all of that. But in my couple of decades of being in a variety of different positions, from launching companies in the sales position, launching different products, working with very large companies to very small startup companies. Again, I've been in the operating room teaching techniques, products, as well as on the pharmaceutical side, really from head to toe in my experience. I consider myself blessed with that to be able to, now where I'm at, blend a lot of that knowledge and expertise with where I am working with my PhD. I have my master's in bioengineering, which was starting to pull that together. And now with my PhD, looking at systems engineering, that human and artificial intelligence gap, bridging that, I've really my where I've been over the years has really helped me with a different perspective of how to look at that interaction, if you will. And I know, your perspective as well as the importance of that human with artificial intelligence in there. So that's kind of where I am today is I am a Kummer Innovation and Entrepreneurship Doctoral Fellow out of Missouri University of Science and Technology of Rolla is where I'm working my PhD. And it's really an honor to be able to have the opportunity working with some amazing people there. And so that's really where I'm. Again, just my overall background and abilities that I've gleaned over the couple few decades is just putting me at a really great place. So it's exciting, one, to see all the excitement coming in it, and then just to have that focus and that way forward based on everything that I've worked for, where I am today.
Wow, what an amazing journey. I'm just blown away. You're dealing and tackling some of the most complex subjects, but the fact that you started and going through the military ranks and being also serving in such a high capacity, visible roles, and also tackling some of the most complex challenges that we're still facing today and finding innovative solution is tremendous. So first of all, kudos. And I absolutely love how you found and navigated and seen what's like not necessarily working maybe the best or not interested as much, or as you said, if it doesn't really get you going and if you're not as passionate, and even though if you have a tremendous knowledge of it, how you also learn to pivot. With that in mind, I'm also blown away. You didn't mention one piece, which I don't know how you do all of this and how you've done it so thus far. You are also wife, you are mother, you have so many hats and many roles. And frankly, for everybody watching and listening, how do you juggle all of that? Just tell us, what is the secret sauce?
Well, I think the priority is really that you have, we was talking about teams, and when it comes to leadership, having a good team that you're developing, working with. And so as our family is really my team, if you will. And so I have great support from that, from my husband supporting all of my academics, my children, and the understanding that some days do get pretty crazy. I am right now with the PhD, I'm focused more on the research. So I've kind of been through the phases where I've had the classes, the finals, where I go lock myself away and no one come knocking on the door. Don't check on me. I'm in a timed test. And it's challenging in some ways, but you also learn the importance of prioritization of what you're doing. But I would also say that sometimes as a mom, as a wife, we almost forget who we are. We almost forget to take care of ourselves. And some people do that in different ways. Exercise, obviously important, or getting time for different things. So because my passion is really the knowledge, the learning, the academics, and because I'm enrolled in these programs, it forces me to take the time to do that. And in fact, when I started working on my master's on the bioengineering, there was a lot of other classes I had to go back and start taking differential equations. So DFUQ class, anyone out there who understands knows the pain and suffering of that class. And my youngest at that time when I started the class was, I think he was 4 weeks old. And so I had four kids in the home with my youngest, 4 weeks old. And then I had to be in class with these other students that were not far off the age of my older children. So it was a very interesting dynamic. And I was taking fluid dynamics as well. And so getting back after a decade from my bachelor's to that was pretty challenging. It was pretty fun. And sharing that, I would say, if anyone, you're never too late to pivot, shift, go to where you need to go. And during that time too, my husband was super supportive. Again, my children were understanding, but also, even though it's an additional stressor, it's a positive stressor to be able to do that. And so I think that's kind of a it's no secret. It's really just making sure that as a family you work together. And it's okay to say on some days where this is just too much, or I'm a little stressed. So if you're coming to me, I may not be as kind to, in this moment as I need to be. So really holding that space for each other is really what's most important.
I love that how real that is, but at the same time how it's possible and how you navigate not only what you do at home but also what you do academically, and then frankly how continue to support others, because obviously you don't not just stop there. You also are part of it, multiple efforts here, specifically also dealing with a Navy SEAL Foundation and many other initiatives that you are bringing together. So, and when we look at all of this, obviously being a psychologist, I'm curious also how much psychology and understanding human dynamics contributes to the success, to your exceptional leadership and also management, not only the time, the process and people, but just overarching understanding where the gaps are and where the common issues and traps are too.
So my background is actually physiology, not psychology, which is a little different. So we do, but with our nonprofit, we have done a lot of work. So the Navy SEALs Fund, FUND, NavySealsFund.org, was founded in 2009 when my husband was actually still active duty, and there was definitely a need for something more flexible, which is interesting because it's a bit of the work that we're doing with the AI is when you have a resource that's available, but if it doesn't fit what you're what's in front of you, then it's really not any good. And actually is in leadership when I was active duty, especially more as a section commander, when people would come forward and say, well, here's what the problem is, I said, that's great. What do you have as a solution? What ideas do you have? I obviously want to know what's going wrong, but I want the opportunity for solving those. And so what we found, really, Navy SEALs Fund was founded in 2009. So we've adapted over the years. We have members that are from all generations because every generation's different, and most people who are in need are afraid to ask. Maybe they're too humble, they're not sure how to ask. And over the years, it changes. And as I mentioned, my father is a Vietnam veteran. When we talk about the psychology side or the mental health needs that are out there, they've changed quite a bit. Also, we've been through COVID, which has also changed a whole lot of different perspectives. And so what's most important is to, one, to be open-minded to what's out there, to always listen first, seek first that knowledge to understand before you start trying to solve problems. Because if you don't know what the problem is, then really whatever solution you bring may not work, and that's a lot of extra time. And when it comes to, in general, what I've found, and just as we're talking about on mental health and the side, if you are thinking on the psychology side, is a lot of times people just want to first know that they've been heard, right? That people are listening and that they care. And so with my background on with the aerospace physiology is really that combination of that physiological impact with the body, as well as then how does it affect the human performance. And the human performance side is really where my passion is. I actually, when I was at the Air Force Academy, I was considering potentially leaving more because I wanted to get into the bioengineering, the biomedical side, because I really loved that interaction. So I was yearning for more of that. And so where we're at on the aerospace, what the aerospace physiology side allowed was more learning of that the body impact and then the mental impact. And then that's what we see a lot today as well, is that it's not just about that mental health, it's the physical health. We have a lot more focus going towards that now as the changes are going on in our government, that hopefully we'll get more of that information, that people can determine what is most important for them. That knowledge is power, because everybody's different. And as I mentioned already, my having my own passion, being able to focus, is what helps people keep moving forward with that.
Brilliant. I love how you're tying, obviously, that experience knowledge, but also how you're recognizing and seeing where the gaps are, specifically when you are also recognizing and as a result created this beautiful foundation and also support to Navy SEALs specifically. But I love, again, kudos to your father and in your military family for serving, but also continue to contribute in civilian efforts, and then also helping to solve still some of the most complex issues that we're still facing, obviously, today. So when you put from vision and role of as well the vision, do you mind for everybody that's watching and listening, tell a little bit about how that mission and vision and role of Navy SEAL Fund got crystallized, and what are you guys up to today? So everybody that wants to support, that they can have opportunity to also support and engage.
Absolutely. So the mission of Navy SEALs Fund is really, it's in general a broad mission focused on a very specific group. And that's by intentional design, because as I mentioned, there's so many different generations of not just Navy SEALs. We also help with the UDT. That was the precursor to the Navy SEALs. So anyone that has served in that specific capacity will help. So pre-9/11, the early ones, which of course they'll have their different needs versus more of the recent Navy SEALs and the challenges from the recent environment. So we'll help all generations. There is also there's no payroll. We're all volunteers, and for us that's important, because then all of the donations that are received really go specifically to what the mission need is. And we do quick reaction funding. So those would be where we've helped families that we had one time a few years ago where they were in the middle of a heat spell in California. There was another crisis going on for them. The air conditioner died, and then within a couple hours, we had already paid. They were able to get out there and take care of that. That seems small to some, but when you're already in the middle of a crisis, just something like that is helpful. And we do help the family members of the SEAL, again, whether they're former active duty, retired veterans. And then we also do help the Gold Star families. And we'll help the Gold Star family members, even the not just the spouse, but the parents, the siblings, and of course the children, which is something that's unique. And that's important to me personally, as the wife of a military service member, of my husband who's retired, the daughter of a military service member, the sister of my two brothers that were both in the military, and also at myself serving, and then as the mother of military service members. So we have two of our boys that were, one is a Former Marine. I know they're never former. I see that every single day in him, but I'm very proud of him. And then our active duty Coast Guard son, and then both my brothers. My one actually was a West Point grad, which was kind of the impetus for me to go look at the service academies. And then my other brother was Army, and then my dad was Army. So, and my husband's Navy, I'm Air Force, and then one of my brothers actually did do a civilian stint to Space Force. So we actually have covered all of the branches that have been presented thus far. But again, so being able to support for that broad range of the Gold Stars is important because sometimes I think when there is a loss on the Gold Star side, obviously the spouse is first impacted, their children are first impacted. But then when I look at my children and their interaction, and you watch them as they grow up, I can't imagine if something happened to one of them, the impact, sorry, it gets me a little choked up, to their brother or sister that's left behind. And so that's why we do that. And as a mom, when I look at my boys, they're in the military, and they're tough, and people, look at them as tough, but those are my babies. They'll probably hate me for saying that. But right, that's when I look at them, and I have to stop sometimes and reflect and think about all of the incredible things that they've done, they're still doing. And so that's something that's important to us. And again, some of the asks aren't huge, and it all falls back to sometimes people just really need to be heard. And then the way for us with the Navy SEALs Fund is we don't spend a lot of time, and why we focus just on that small group is it's easy for us to really validate who they are and what the need is so that we don't have a ton of paperwork that we're having to manage before we're able to get care, because it's hard for people first to ask for help, and then it's hard then if they're having to do the paperwork, if they're having to share all this information, they may not ask for help. And then that also stems from, again, part of what I bring to part of that process. One is from my husband, retired SEAL, and he was always sharing kind of that perspective of the people, how they obviously they don't want to share that. And then also my mother, when she had cancer, I lost my mother to cancer a few years ago, but when they were in the midst of that struggle, I remember my parents not getting a lot of the assistance that was available because, again, when you're in the middle of a crisis, you don't have the time or the extra bandwidth to be able to go pull up documents, submit this and this and that, because you're just trying to survive to the next moment. And so that's where for us with the Navy SEALs Fund, our goal and our focus is always to be able to meet the people that we help where they are, when they need it, and to just get the work done, to just get it done, which is really the whole mantra as far as with Navy SEALs. And so that's our focus. We help with that quick reaction funding. We've also done a lot with the PTSD TBI support. And we don't have a specific program because we remain flexible so that, again, we can help them where they are with what they need. If one program doesn't work, then we want to go look at something else. And then with my background, my academic background, we'll still look. We're not funding anything that's really crazy out there. We have a lot of resources, and we do work a lot with the other charities as well to really maximize where another charity might have some additional resources or areas that they focus on so that we're not reinventing the wheel. But we work together as well with our overall goal is really to help maximizing care for the community. So that's really, so the Navy SEALs Fund priority, we do the quick reaction funding, the PTS TBI support, and then we just are ready to be flexible to whatever that need is as it changes. And we even saw that with COVID, the nice thing because we don't have salaries, we don't have to worry about that. There was never any stop in operation of us being able to help. We don't have facilities to maintain any of that. So we just continue to adapt and to help to whatever that need is.
I'm just blown away how, first of all, how much you accomplish and achieve it, and you just keep surprising me as we talk more and discover more. But I love what you did because we know it's so many different programs and they're very rigid in their approaches. And I love that you're tool agnostic, that you're staying and remaining flexible, but most importantly, you meeting every single one of them where they are. And I think that is tremendous setup for great success. And I also love what you said, how important it is for them to know that they have a sense of where they can belong and also where they're welcome and how they're also being treated, at that overarching mission and success that you are creating attraction behind it. It's just, again, for everybody watching and listening, you have to go check it out, the Navy SEAL Fund, and understand a little bit better ways to engage and support, but in the same time was a great model that can be easily also expand upon, but also replicated for others, because so many are struggling and need is tremendous. And it's always great to see what's working and what is not. So thank you. Reflecting now on everything you achieved and continue, now you're also adding this human AI, and you're solving something that we see happening tremendously around AI gap in healthcare. We touched on a little bit of mental health and healthcare in general, but also innovative aspects of it with biotechnology and system engineering. Those are such a complex overarching issues that also tie together, but that I'm really eager to hear because you're not only pioneering that right now, and we've seen so much shifts with AI, but you're adding that layer to solve some of these healthcare issues, including mental health, as well as leveraging your biotechnology and system and engineering background. How is that possible? Please let us know.
And again, it's all just coming perfectly together, so it is super exciting. Although my advisor has been amazingly patient. He's been in this field for since really systems engineering began, and I'm sure some days I might drive him a little crazy because I get all these great ideas, and so I'm like a little rabbit running into all these holes. Just the potential is incredible. However, there's a lot of scare factor out there with AI. Not to say that there shouldn't be some concerns. It's about having that constraint and that understanding of what AI is as far as buzzwords go. So, AI is really, it's artificial intelligence, which quite simply the reason it's called artificial intelligence is it really works the same way that our intelligence works, the way our brain works. So if you ask me to solve a problem, what I'm going to do is I'm going to reflect back on my experience, maybe my personal experience, maybe it's my book knowledge, maybe I'm going to go research a little bit on it, and then I'm going to compile all that information and I'm going to provide an answer to you of, okay, here's how we're going to solve the problem. So that's exactly what artificial intelligence is. The difference, though, is where is this artificial intelligence getting its data? That's really, I think, where I would say the concern is understanding where that AI comes from. And we've even seen it in simple things where people start playing, where initially they started playing with the ChatGPT, the little AI bots, they start programming and they'll put screenshots out all over social media of, I asked it this, this is what it told me, it's so biased. Well, yes, it's biased because it's only going to provide you an answer based on what the information is that went into it. So, does it mean that AI is bad everywhere? No, it just depends on what you're using it for. So, when I started working on my current project with the Missouri Science and Technology team, my background of on the medical side was actually really exciting to them because we're working on a project with transplant, with organ transplant, and specifically my area of focus. And on my LinkedIn, there's a link too. I'm starting to build my Google Scholar file. I think there's one paper in there. There's a couple that I've also been able to help with, but with hard to place kidneys. And so when we look at that decision-making process, and again, the AI is being designed to help supplement the decision-making process. The initial hurdle that they had is you have all these engineers that are great at programming. They know how to write code, Python, C sharp, whatever it is. But when they're talking to the medical team, trying to figure out that translation of, well, what does the medical team who, there are some doctors, some of the medicine that maybe have some backgrounds in software engineering, but most of them, they're focused on the human body, on solving that problem. So they don't know how to tell the software engineer, this is how you program it. This would be the code line that you use. And then the person coding it doesn't quite understand the difference on what creatine clearance is, what is glomeruli, what is this? Where's the kidney? Why is the kidney different than the liver versus the heart when it comes to transplant? There's a lot of different nuances in there. And so my part coming in as the first part was figuring out that information, right? So when we talk about maybe bias and ethics when it comes to AI, there's a whole different paradigm too when you talk about applying it to medicine, right? So let me just reflect back when I mentioned about you go online and you Google AI of, what's the best route to drive from A to B or whatever it is, and it'll give you an answer, and maybe it's biased because you have a person who likes city traffic versus a person who wants to drive out in the country, right? So there's going to be kind of that bias. Some of the initial bias, people were concerned about political bias, social bias. Well, when it comes to medicine, there's also a lot of talk of bias that's in there. And it's also what I'm finding is interesting is as you build this AI and healthcare team, you have your engineers concerned about a bias that's different than the medical team's bias, right? Where there's concern in medicine of we want to make sure that we're giving appropriate healthcare to all comers. So if you come because you need a transplant, we're just looking at you as someone who is in need of a transplant, not because of your race or your gender, that we're going to say, yes, you get it or no, you don't. Right. So there's that piece of it. But yet within healthcare, there are different biases that maybe because of ethnicity, there is different medical issues that come with it. Right. So it has to be considered in it, potentially in medical decisions in general, but that's not necessarily a hard stop as far as bias goes. I don't know if that's making sense, but the programmer might say, okay, well, we don't want bias for these five things that are attributes that are very specific attributes. And so we don't want bias. Bias is bad. Get rid of those attributes. But the physician might say, well, we don't necessarily get rid of those because some of the bias that comes from those attributes are important in my decision making, right? Because it brings about different healthcare concerns, right? Where if you're obese, you have different healthcare needs. So I'm not biased that I just don't want to care for an obese person. So we shouldn't put that in an algorithm that using obesity is bad, but we need to make sure understand why that's important in the decision-making process. And so for what my part that I'm bringing now is this is the research is developing is working specifically with that building a program then that's based off of the current algorithm that was built to say in that decision-making process for you, Surgeon A. So if I'm dealing with Surgeon Isabella, what is important for you based on where you're at, based on the patient population that you're managing, based on your years of expertise that you've seen work and not work, of all of these different attributes that were put in, what's most important to you? Right. Because right now, an algorithm is based off of a national data set, and there's a lot of areas online that you can go to. And you can kind of play with building your own AI system because there's just national data that's dumped in. There's a different opportunity with this shared network, if you will, to build different AI systems. But it's a national data set. And then within that national data set, there is a lot of extra information that may or may not be important for that decision. And so the initial algorithm is already a little biased because you may not want to build it based off of thousands of levels of data. So you are going to parse it down to the top, maybe 50 that are important. So you already have a little bit of bias. And now what I'm trying to do is say, okay, but how do we tailor it almost like a boutique type AI? And a couple of things that we're hoping happen from that is, number one, the surgeon that's involved in it is going to start to understand where that initial AI even came from, right? Because that's a trust factor.
Yes.
Right? That's where a lot of people say, well, I don't trust AI. Where is this AI coming from? And so they don't want to use it. The other trust factor is they feel like they're trying to be replaced with it.
So true.
Right. But and that as a patient, you know, I wouldn't want to walk into a checkup with my doctor and they go, okay, talk to the camera, tell them all your problems. And then when I come back, we'll see what it kicks out, right? Where it sends you like a little piece of paper and says, here's what's wrong with you. And then your doctor goes, oh yeah, that's right. Like, I wouldn't want that. Nobody wants that because we don't trust it. We don't know where it's getting the information from. So by kind of building this program where the surgeon or the human is more involved with the AI, they're first going to be able to say, okay, this was a decision that the AI system said, okay, put in. So in this particular example, I have a hard to place kidney. Here's the information that was put in, and here's what it said that, yes, it'll be hard to place, but the likelihood of success of if you use this kidney or organ that the patient will have success is whatever percent. And so the surgeon right now would say, oh, okay, I like that. And I kind of agree with it. But right now it's based off of a national data set. So what I'm working on is how do I bring in that one surgeon then to, as we look at that data, pull in their specific unique expertise into that. And then that again is that translation problem I talked about of you have the coding that was set up versus how a surgeon speaks. So what I'm using is fuzzy associative memory to bridge that gap. So essentially fuzzy associative memory will take that common language of the surgeon, the physician, you know, and this could be applied to any domain, right? Figure out whatever that language is that's common to them. And then we will look at these attributes that were used in the algorithm and then have that person say, you know, yes, I agree with it. No, I don't. And then here's the weighting of importance of where I see it affecting my decision. And that's again, based off of my patient population. You know, a surgeon in Missouri is going to be different than a surgeon in California, Florida, Idaho. They see different patients. If you see more elderly, more obese, or whatever it is, or just the different medical support, the health of the patients. So they may say, okay, these are the attributes that I agree are important. Here's the weighting of what those attributes are. And then, oh, by the way, even though the algorithm was great with those, whatever, 50 inputs, here's an additional maybe 20 inputs that I consider personally that go into it. So then we build it around what that personal need is. And then from that, with we develop the rules of the rules that they're using to make that decision. And the biggest challenge right now is really pulling those rules because, again, we make decisions, and especially one of the big things that I've learned from my husband that's been my challenge, because I'm very thoughtful. I will plod along in making decisions because I'm trying to analyze everything. But based on where he's been as a Navy SEAL, he has to make decisions that it's black or white. You got to go now. Right. And so those decisions, if I were to try to stop them and say, okay, wait, tell me why, like, Can you list all the reasons, all your rules? He would look at me like I'm crazy. But that's what, right? But that's what I'm trying to do. Same thing with the surgeon who's been, making these decisions over a couple decades. And I'm now trying to find out what those specific rules and attributes they use so I can build it into the system to make sure that it's truly being considered. And then when that kind of upgraded algorithm, if you will, is built, it's very specific for them. And then when it's more like a peer for them, so that then when they have a hard to place case, or they could apply really to any case, but we talk hard to place because decisions have to be made quickly. When you have, and we're working right now with deceased donor patients to, once they find the match for really, the heart, the lungs, then it's go time. And then they're going to start harvesting the organs. And if they haven't found a match for the other organs, I mean, that's where that countdown starts to happen. Right? So it's not as a living donor, you have a potentially a little bit more time to make sure everything is a good match for that patient with the person that's receiving it. Versus if you have the deceased donor who, once they start identifying that these other organs are a match, you're going to start running out of time to be able to use the additional organs, if that makes sense. And so that's where this decision-making support tool more or less helps to expedite that decision, checking off a lot of boxes so they could then say that this will be hard to place with good success if we now adjust where we are on that list of potential recipients, because there's a whole process that goes through. And again, remember too, the algorithm is based off of prior cases that they looked at. And that decision-making process is a whole giant team. It's not just the surgeon, the patient receiving. It is you have the bureaucracy of what the right rules are for getting approval for the whole system. So there's a whole lot going on in it. So now we're taking that and putting it a little bit more into the hands of the surgeons so they feel that there's more of a peer. And then the other potential applications would even be where, as we build it for the individual surgeon, you could even build it for that group of surgeons. So the surgical group, or they maybe come up with what their model is so that if it's the middle of the night or it's a hard time, instead of having to make the phone call to everyone, the more tailored AI can give them already that initial indication. So as that surgeon's making the decision, they can go, okay, what did this tailored AI tell me? They said yes, they would accept it or no. And then now I feel, again, it's more like that peer having that discussion with them. So that's the exciting part of bringing that human into that loop, because then they start to understand that transparency of where the data came from. They feel like they're part of making that decision. And again, it's not to replace the human, it's really just to help with making, I don't want to say a better decision, but it helps them with that decision process. In exploring all of the information that's in there. So then you pick up that model and you can apply it to different places in healthcare. So really what I'm doing is just kind of in the early stages of how do we bridge that gap, that human and artificial intelligence. And so when I talk about human AI team, I really am talking about them working together as a team in the decision part, versus if you think of an industrial of the human, more or less just kind of getting information from an AI system. We're really trying to build it so you truly are like your team if you sit down and have a round table type discussion. So that's what's super exciting. And it's also exciting that we see in the last few weeks all of the additional information out there, the investment into AI, because AI really is the way that things are going forward. But
Yes.
we, again, not to be fearful, but we need to be mindful of how that AI is being used, because the potential is huge. And when it comes to healthcare, though, it's not about replacing the human side, because as I mentioned, the hardest part of what I'm doing right now is I'm trying to pull those rules out. How are you making the decisions? And sometimes it's just that, sometimes it's just that gut feeling. And so we need to use as a tool to supplement the work that we're doing.
Brilliant. As I was listening to you sharing and learning from concept of FASI, associative memory, and also deep learning, and also these network models and protocols, and then obviously governing that is now required, right? Just not because of healthcare itself, but also all the other pieces too. I feel like it's so great to see what's possible. And as you pioneer in this, I can't wait where things are gonna go in the next few years, because obviously I never seen as fast adaptation and as aspects of, you know, of possibilities and examples that can truly show and save time, money, resources, but in the same time position us in realm of complex issues that we're still obviously struggling to solve them. And I'm just thinking, and more obviously looking from that aspects and your contribution that and achievements thus far in biotech, it's specifically in medicine and those innovative solutions and procedures. I'm curious, what is one thing that you anticipate it's going to happen and you cannot wait to see to unfold, because it's obviously so much there, but one thing that you can see about how this can change either patient care, how it can change our own individual journeys and make it a million times better. What would that be?
Yeah, that would be one of my rabbit holes I usually start to go down that actually got me excited getting into the work I'm doing. And from my experience in the medical sales, where, and also with the Navy SEALs Fund, is that sometimes we have these diagnoses that occur. For example, for a period of time, there was a lot of ALS that we were seeing in need of support with the Navy SEALs Fund and members. And in talking with some of them and their family, the challenge was that they didn't see that that's where they were going until they had that diagnosis. But then once they had that diagnosis, then they'd sit back and they'd go, oh, I remember that one time a couple years ago, I had a little weakness. I thought I just tripped. Or I thought this event occurred because of some other reason, where they had a different excuse, if they will, that they tried to rationalize it. And now that they have the diagnosis, they go, ah, aha, that's why. And so the ability for artificial intelligence to be used, one of the areas that I'm excited about it, potential, there's so many different areas, but is the ability to start again identifying what the potential problem is earlier, identifying what it potentially is early, so you may be able to avoid what the final outcome might be of continuing that disease state road, or you can start early intervention to increase the quality of life during that time period. So there's a couple of different options, and especially on the rare disease side, because when we go see our family practice medicine, internal medicine, they have so much knowledge that they're responsible for as far as trying to understand when you come in with what your conditions are, really what's going on potentially with you. So the what artificial intelligence would do is not to flag a patient that this is the disease that they absolutely have, but to potentially identify the trend sooner for those patients. So that's the good and the bad of electronic medical records, really, you know, because the potential when you have everything up in the cloud of things being accessible to the wrong players, everyone has a little trepidation of that. The benefit is that with all of that medical information there, if you have, again, the right programming for the artificial intelligence that could go back through and say that, okay, my specialty is neurology, and when I finally get my patient to me that has their medical case, okay, the family practice asked these questions, but here's the additional questions that I asked the patient. And so from all of this data, I now diagnose them with this disease state. Well, if we can take that specialist, again, not to replace them, but to then give that knowledge, if you will, sooner to your family practice or internal medicine, whoever your primary doctor is, to kind of look through the records, then that would be like your family medicine sitting there looking through your case going, oh goodness, this is kind of weird. What do I do with it? And now it's like they have that neurologist or whatever that specialist is, the nephrologist standing next to them to say, what do you think? And they would be like, well, send them over to me because this is what it might be. Or really a collective of a couple specialists that could say, nope, this doesn't apply to me. Oh yes, this does. And again, not to replace, but maybe to help in that earlier identification where maybe it would give additional questions to ask, additional testing to look for, so that again, not always to prevent the disease, but that quality support. So mentioning ALS, by the time most people are diagnosed, it's devastating downhill pretty quick versus having an ability with different medicine or interventions to maybe increase that quality of life longer for them or increase the other potential. You know, cancer, I don't know, cancer, we need something different. We absolutely need something different than even beyond our conventional medicine. So when I was working on my master's in bioengineering, I was also looking at nanotechnology. The potential for nanotechnology to get involved and start to really identify the specific cancer, it's mind-blowing. And they're doing a lot with even like immune type focus, because the old treatment and what's still primarily used is, well, we know we need to kill the cancer, but everything's affected. And it's just detrimental. So maybe it's not the cancer you die from, it's the other things that were affected in your body that you lose your quality of life. And then that's what causes the loss of life. So being able to use this artificial, again, it's the artificial intelligence you put in the information, it's helping us to direct us in really that innovation to find so many different ways that we can start making a difference that's different. Again, I think the trap is that let's not program it based on our current knowledge, but leave some gaps out there for what potentially could be. And that's where I'll do a little plug here, where I think that some of the regulation needs to get out of the way. So that smaller companies, smaller individuals have the ability to bring innovation. Right now, if you don't have the financial resources, you know, you're not going to be able to make the FDA requirements of how to run your test and all these different nuances, which are important, right? But there's a point to which some of the financial requirements to run these tests meet what the United States requires, I think are almost limiting our ability to solve problems. One of the other interesting sides of working on my master's and my PhD is that there are a lot of foreign international students that are in these programs with me, because their countries send them here to learn some of the latest, the greatest, what's going on, technology. Yes. And they pick it up, they get, you know, and also learning from them too, as far as on the cultural side, because they see things different. We learn so much too, but the difference is that they don't necessarily have the same EPA or FDA restrictions when they go back home. And so they can take this information and they can go do other great things with it. And so I think that we need a little government balance. And you mentioned, I think we were talking about the AI regulations.
Yes.
Which again falls in, some regulations are good, some are restricting. where if we're required to give all of our information to the government to tell us yes or no, well, you know, the government, when it comes to AI, they want all of the coding, they want all of the source, this or that. Well, what are they doing with that? Right. So there needs to be a bit, of a balance to really allow for innovation to truly occur. There needs to be some way to let some of the smaller, if you will, players to really have the opportunity to develop, right? You see a lot of the big companies that support pay for some of the different research. Well, then now they've kind of got their eye and their hand in it. And so then you read these papers and you go, well, let's talk about bias. What's the bias involved there, right? Would they have found a different solution if they didn't have company A or B paying for this research or whatever it is? You always have to be kind of mindful of that as well. But I think that for the future, I mean, as we always say, we're only limited by ourselves. And I think collaboration is important. That's one thing on the academic side that's really, I've learned a lot, is when we have these groups and we learn and talk to each other more and see, but also exploring beyond. So, you know, some of what's applied in one business area, maybe it doesn't initially make sense that it would apply to healthcare or vice versa, but when you break it down to the fundamentals, it might be, you know, there's so many different items and ideas that based on space travel that were brought back and applied to medicine or other areas. So I think that, yeah, that's when we talk about artificial intelligence in the future and the amazing great things, there are some areas I get really excited about on the potential for quality of life. And again, I look at it as it creates an opportunity for us to make better decisions, to do more. So it doesn't scare me, but I think that's where that transparency and the more information that we know behind it will make a difference. And then hopefully anyone that's listening to that, maybe they'll feel a little more confident about it, that it just needs to be just understood, that transparency a little bit more on exactly what it is and knowing how you're using it, where that information came from when you're making your own decisions with it.
Love it. I can't agree more, because again, unless we have struck the balance between corporate arena and government and find the medium of how do we go about it and what is intent behind it, then we can truly achieve exactly what you're talking about, to really serve and create tremendous shift and impact on how we live life, how we extend longevity, how we also treat chronic diseases, how we also understand some of them before even becoming chronic, which I love, focus on health prevention and issues that we're seeing. Unfortunately, growing up in Europe, our health was on the preventative side, and coming to the United States, seeing the opposite, always puzzled me. I never really understood till I really start thinking, oh, it's a capitalistic system. It's actually a business. It's really serving greater thing. But when if you have a very unhealthy nation, and we unfortunately see very gloomy statistics just right now in the United States, it's alarming. We have to look at and do better. And knowing now that we know what we know, we can obviously self-sustain and sustain future generation on the frameworks that we're having here in healthcare and mental health, as well as those innovative solution and biotechnology and everything you talked about. So I really want to say this is so eye-opening and refreshing and exciting. And I really look forward to see what this comes about. And really what I wanted to, in closing here, you walk us through this beautiful journey from being this Air Force powerhouse to obviously be now involved in AI healthcare and finding ways to innovate and transform industries. So with everybody watching and listening, specifically leaders that are stretching their head, that are over their head with all the magnitude of implications AI itself alone, one piece of advice that you want to give as a closing remarks, because obviously, what do they you think fundamentally are missing? And if they focus on that one thing, that's going to set them up for that success as we're navigating all these complexities.
For me, it's really the why behind the what. And this is even before Simon Sinek. It's done a lot with that. That's something that I've always, I think, as an engineer, where my mindset has always been on engineering, and to the point that I'm probably a bit annoying sometimes with people, is that I really need to understand the why. Whenever in any position that I've ever had, when I'm asked to do, ABC, XYZ, the more I understand the why behind it, the more it helps me to be a better worker, right? And then as a leader, when you have someone that that you're in charge of that is doing different things, one, have you shared with them as much as you can the why? Do they understand why you're asking them to do these things? Right. And then if they're not quite delivering on what your expectations are, did you ask yourself why? Like, why are they having these challenges? So I think that why is so powerful from the giver and the receiver behind that. And that's what I would just, when things are starting to go a little bit here and there, if you can, I think you just need to stop and say, okay, well, why is this happening? Let me understand more, because you're not going to be able to solve any problems if you don't understand that why. And if you have a client that you're serving, do you know their why? Don't assume that if they say, I need a house built with four rooms and a bathroom, have you asked them why? Why is that their focus? Because that how you design in your mind to make it may not meet their needs. So I think really that why is truly, truly powerful as a leader, as a servant. Why am I doing this on the hard days? I have to remind myself when it does get crazy. Why am I doing this? All right, because of this, because of that. And I think that's what's so important, is that fundamental of why, why did you start? Why is this going on? And that's what I would leave people with, to kind of pause and reflect on the why behind the what.
At the end of your life, what will be your legacy? What will you leave behind for future generations? For the world? Join the World Messenger, Isabella Lundberg. Each week, as she brings you a new distinguished guest from the business, sports, or entertainment world to share their success, their struggles, and their lessons. They will share their insights into current hot topics that affect everyone. Isabella facilitates an intimate, vulnerable environment to find the true value of humanity and real leadership. Are you ready for your legacy? The legacy that matters?